Welcome to episode 33 of Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and each week I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. This week's guest is Lars Johnson, Chief Technology Officer at STEM. We talked about what motivates and excites him at STEM, how he ended up there, and what his vision for the future is. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com. STEM combines big data, predictive analytics, and energy storage to reduce electric costs for businesses and, in aggregate, deliver services to the grid. STEM optimizes the value of their customers' energy assets and facilitates their participation in energy markets, yielding economic and societal benefits while decarbonizing the grid. Prior to joining STEM, Lars was CTO at Siemens Digital Grid, which he joined via the acquisition of eMeter, a Bay Area software company of which he was co-founder and responsible for innovation and development of meter data management, analytics, and advanced smart grid applications. Prior to eMeter, he co-founded Cellnet Data Systems, a pioneer in wireless networks for smart metering and distribution automation. He earned his BS and an MS in mechanical engineering from Stanford University. Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and I'm sitting down talking with Lars Johnson. He is the Chief Technology Officer at STEM. With regard to climate change, can you talk about the motivating moment when you decided to get involved in doing something about it?
Oh boy, that goes back quite a ways. I'm going to date myself. It's probably 35 plus years ago. And frankly, the beginning of my journey in this space was much more about energy efficiency. And in that sense, the very broad category of how do we improve electric power distribution and consumption. And it started off with this very simple concept that I thought was really reasonable, which was time of use metering. And my co-founder of a first company back in the 80s, and I decided that we needed to somehow make it possible to provide time of use metering so that time of use pricing could affect the load factor of the distribution grids and the power distribution and generation in these networks, and therefore improve efficiency, reduce the need for new generation. And at that point, it wasn't so much about climate change, it was just the right thing to do. And somewhere along the way, it became the right thing to do because here's the impact of not doing the right thing. So I still very much believe that doing the right thing is being efficient with resources. But I think in the subsequent years, that messaging about why to do it has become about how the inefficient generation and consumption and utilization of energy is hurting us. And that's really a change that's happened since I started this journey so many years ago.
With the increase of solar on the grid, time of use and when you use energy has a much larger impact than it did back when you started.
Absolutely. And frankly, what's happening now is that the introduction of solar is actually changing that load factor. And the whole duck curve phenomenon here in California and certainly in Hawaii is evidence of how introducing and adopting renewables, and solar in particular, is changing the way that distribution grids and generation need to be operated in order to maintain and sustain efficiency gains that we've come to expect.
Can you talk about why mitigating climate change is personally important to you?
I think it's that thing that makes you feel good about what you do every day when you get up and go do something, right? And I spend so much of my waking hours doing something related to what I call work and what I get paid for that I want to feel good about what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. There's been a lot of times when I've been at cocktail parties back in the long time ago when I talked about things like smart metering and distribution grids, and people would sort of yawn and was like, okay, on to the next topic sort of thing. But I think what I've found is that I feel good about what I do. The people that I am able to employ want to be part of that same kind of mission. And that now with the last several years of emphasis on climate change and renewable energy, it's become a very interesting topic for a lot more people. So it's very positive reinforcement in that thing. But I still will go back to my roots. It's the right thing to do, to be efficient in how we use resources. And that has got a very profound effect on how we do a lot of things. But in this case, it's got a very profound effect on GHGs and generation.
One of the speakers at my daughter's graduation last year said that if you're going to work 40 to 80 hours a week for some company, you should agree with what they're doing, that it matters. That's kind of what you're saying.
Absolutely. How could you go to work 8 hours and do something that you really didn't think was important? I mean, I'm sure there's a large number of people out there, and unfortunate for them that they don't have that feeling. I'm fortunate that this has been the thing that I've been able to do now for better than three decades.
How do you explain climate change to people that don't believe or don't understand it?
I'll go back to that, the fundamental thing is it's still the right thing to do. You don't have to believe in any scientific evidence that suggests we have certain warming trends or factors that are, let's say, catastrophic or, you know, fundamental end of the world sort of scenarios. But I think you can still think that it's the right thing to do. And I think what's happening now is doing the right thing has also become the cost-effective thing. That is, the long-term and sustainable costs of using renewable energy will be profoundly beneficial just as on an economic basis. So I think doing the right thing is now becoming doing the cost-effective thing, and the more that we get there, the better it's going to be. So things that can help us ensure that the cost structures are continuing to decline, that proper incentives and policies are put in place to make sure that we drive the kind of decision-making behavior that I think those are going to continue to be really super important transformations. And we see that happening.
So if not for climate change, why would using gasoline or coal or natural gas not be the right thing?
I am a pragmatist in so many ways. We're not going to eliminate the gasoline cars right away. We're not going to have 100% renewables transition in a matter of months. We have to do this over time. And over time, we're going to find that natural gas certainly is a transition fuel, although there's evidence today that in many locations, not everywhere, but in many locations, that solar and storage, you know, are a better alternative and can provide a sustainable resource. But I think we need to have transition. We need to have a way to make it possible to go from point A to point B. And quite honestly, today, I'm not sure that the long-term 100% renewable vision is clear enough to say how it's going to actually work. I know we're going to get there. I'm not going to say when it's going to be, and I'm not going to say what's going to work in all regions, because every region's got different characteristics. And certainly transmission construction is a question about how do we make that future happen as well.
Yeah, I think distributed energy versus centralized energy, I don't think the jury's out yet when you consider which is the easiest, fastest way to do it. I think there are benefits in both, and maybe the answer is both.
Yeah, I think it has to be. And I have a bias. I'll be real clear on that. I have a bias towards distributed. I have a bias towards customer-centric. And I think what I would love to see from a distributed future is that, you know, essentially every building is its own microgrid, and every building has its own resiliency with storage and on-site generation of some form, even if it's just a few solar panels. But that's not going to be every building, and it's not likely to be reasonable to have net zero on every building, or even zero energy, you know, an islanding capability in every building. But I think if we can understand that that's a possibility, and that there's a future state that might incorporate that kind of future, I think that gives us the sort of a direction. And I think that coupled with, well, what do we need to support the grid at the transmission level? What do we need to support the capacity that we can't generate through that on-site customer-owned generation? It would be the really interesting way to think about this problem.
Yeah, I think it's healthy to have a direction, even if you don't know exactly how you're going to get to that end state. We certainly have a lot of the pieces of the recipe already here.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that's the interesting part. I think this is where the economics are continuing to improve in favor of that kind of end state. And I think to a large extent, we see leading regulatory policies that are starting to take into account things like, you know, locational value, things like interconnection policies, and things like incentives for storage or continued ITC for solar, and maybe one day also hopefully for storage as well. And those two things really make a big difference. And at the same time, being a pragmatic person, I will say things like fuel cells and natural gas generation, combined heat and power resources, can also now offer some really exciting combinations as well, which I think take us down the path in the right way. So I believe that sort of combination and that mix of resource can fundamentally help create that distributed future that I think will be the most effective for us.
Talk about STEM. What does STEM do, and what do you do at STEM?
Well, of course, STEM helps achieve that distributed future. But quite honestly, yes, I spent 4 years with Siemens, and prior to that with two startups in the Bay Area. And the activity with Siemens was primarily at the distribution grid and distribution and transmission grid levels. And it was, you know, very apparent at that point that the transformation effect of customer pull for solar, right? I mean, there's certainly large-scale solar being done, but what was really transforming the market as I saw it was what was happening in commercial and residential solar projects. And I think that led me to this idea that storage was going to be an important piece of this. Storage was beginning to become a thing. And I was fortunate enough to have an opportunity to join one of the leading storage solution developers and platforms, a company called STEM, which is located in the Bay Area. So it was in my neighborhood, and I'm responsible for the product and technology development at STEM. And we provide intelligent energy storage operations. We actually offer a turnkey storage as a service, and we use software using a lot of AI and forecasting and modeling and prediction to optimize that storage asset, which we typically would install at a customer facility, typically commercial industrial customers. And then we provide them value, which is realized both in the form of bill savings from their utility billing, but also participation in various forms of energy markets and what we call grid services. So we're helping to leverage a customer-sided energy resource and the flexibility that it offers to help the customer, and also to help the customer by monetizing that in grid-facing markets.
And the grid part of that savings also helps the grid.
Absolutely. I mean, the fundamentals of most of the programs that we participate in, and even market direct market pricing, is all about balancing supply, demand, and alleviating congestion. And those things are now becoming more and more important as the dynamics of renewables, especially solar, are creating these opportunities that are changing those characteristics so that, you know, more traditional power plant resources have a harder time dealing with that. So things like morning and evening ramps, you know, shifting energy from the peak solar generation hours to the off-peak, accommodating now from the customer's perspective the new shift in time of use rates from a 4 p.m. to 9 p.m.
I can use some storage right now.
Absolutely. I mean, we help the customers accommodate that fact that today the peak times are at the very end of your workday and when you get home, not in the middle to the afternoon.
You mentioned Siemens and E-Meter. Can you talk about what you did at those companies and how you got where you are today?
Yeah, the way back is the first company was called Cellnet Data Systems. It was eventually acquired by Landis+Gyr Gear. And that company was all about doing the wireless networking for smart metering. So it was we were the first to deploy a smart metering wireless network-based solution back at Kansas City and St. Louis with the first two customers back in the mid-80s. From that activity, and this metering was essentially, let's call it, each meter was chirping its energy usage every 5 minutes.
Chirping, is that a technical term?
It was. I was about to say tweeting, but I thought, no, we weren't tweeting back then. But we were sending energy consumption information every few minutes back to collection system that brought it back to the utilities and literally had information about power flows at interval levels for any kind of time of use metering or billing related to these TOU programs that I've been talking about. But what we found back then was that most of the utilities did not have the data systems to deal with that. So Cellnet up, running, good, and then move on to E-Meter. E-Meter is the catcher for that data, basically consuming smart meter data, and ultimately became the leading company for what became the space known as meter data management. Somewhat limiting term in that sense, because in fact what that platform eventually became, both within E-Meter and then ultimately within Siemens, was the platform for what today is the DERMS platform or the DRMS, where, you know, you're combining this platform of information about customer energy consumption with the idea that you want to interact with that same consumer by giving them price signals and that are maybe dynamic, such as a critical peak price, you know, or a real-time price, or in the case of a customer with some kind of load management, you know, a signal that they could use to mitigate their energy costs by responding to a price signal like a CPP. And of course, how do you settle that? With metering data. So there's this consistent theme from time of use through dynamic pricing to saying, hey, we got to acquire it, we got to manage it, and we got to use it for settlement.
I remember all those problems and all those terms you just used are now coming back to me.
Acronym city.
Yes. I think we met while you were at E-Meter.
I'm sure we did. I know that we might have met before that, because I remember one of the first time of use metering evaluations was done by San Diego Gas and Electric and a fellow named Mark Howell.
Oh, yes.
You may remember.
I remember him very well.
And so I won't even go back to what year that was, but that was a very long time ago. But we were looking at how, again, to provide information for billing so that price signals for customer behavior shaping could be employed.
And what are challenges that you've experienced in your career?
I think probably the most interesting thing about being in this business is the regulatory policy dynamic that I think creates an interesting set of economics and motivations for people in the industry. And I'll say utilities, certainly, policymakers often, and then suppliers who have to work within this regulated business. So I think probably the hardest thing for me is to understand how what I think would make both technical and commercial sense is actually going to come to pass. Because you can envision something as straightforward as, wow, wouldn't it be nice to charge by time of day when energy costs vary by time of day and to pass those customers along to motivate people and encourage consumers to opt for efficient behaviors. And yet it takes a very long time. Witness mandatory time of use or default time of use now, literally 35 years later. I never would have foreseen that when we got started down this journey many years ago.
Even that isn't perfect because it's big blocks. It doesn't look at whether you really need it on that day, and
absolutely,
yet it's incenting things that you probably don't need most of the time.
Absolutely. And our first proposal for deploying a technology with a utility, this is back, again, in the mid-80s, was to be able to use technology available back then, which was power line communication and telephone modems and so forth, but to retrieve hourly data for every customer every day. And that was the basis for saying, hey, then you can offer all sorts of flexibility, right? And the granularity is at least close to the market settlement intervals and all those other good things for price transparency. But at that point, the only thing that people were willing to actually buy, people being utilities, were lower cost means to deploy time of use capabilities. Which, again, was great because it got started and that, I think, then sort of spurred a lot of what became the smart grid movement that came out of California fundamentally and in many ways was launched when California adopted smart metering practices and policies back in the early 90s.
I think that was a huge turning point. And not only did meter data get better, but it also set up the ability to bring on electric vehicles and solar and not have to have new meters put in every time somebody wanted to move in that direction. Now everybody has the meter already there to allow them to go on special rates for those.
Absolutely. And that's the kind of enabling technology and the enabling capability that I think was envisioned when it was first deployed, I think. And I think it's unfortunate that I think people, generally speaking, still don't recognize that enablement that provides, and witness the fact that we still have only, 60% of the meters in the U.S. are part of a smart metering program. And there's a great problem in a lot of things. And for STEM, for example, when we want to provide a customer with a value proposition around energy storage, the first thing we do is we ask for 12 months of their interval data, which in California with smart metering is actually something we can reasonably ask for and get in a fairly short order. In some cases, electronically through things like green button and access methods electronically. But where we don't have that, it's very, very challenging and very risky for us to make a proposal because we can't tell you exactly what that load shape is going to be and how your peaks can be offset or how much energy we can offset or what size system we should deploy in order to optimize that value for you as a customer. But where we have smart meter data access, no problem.
I'm a data person. I love data. So you won't hear me complaining, though I do remember the days when people were rioting against smart meters, although I think that's died down.
I think so. I think we have to show, and it's, again, what we're doing with STEM is we're showing why it's valuable. We're showing a customer, here's the value we can bring to you. Same thing with solar providers, right? When a solar provider says, here's how much energy I can charge you, I can deliver with a solar panel and sizing the solar panel system, they could take advantage of your own load shape and the time of use practices that are being put in place, right? And now changes in NEM tariffs, NEM 2 and so forth, and they can actually run through a process of modeling, how much that panel is going to save you and earn you ultimately in your on-site generation.
Can you talk about the successes you're most proud of?
Look, I think there's a sequence here that I'm very proud of. One of which is building a company that led the way in the smart metering deployments. So we ultimately had 16 million points in the U.S. as part of networks that we built through that first company, Cellnet. That led to the second major source of pride, which is a enduring platform that is being used internationally now for, you know, managing meter data and providing a foundation for distributed resource management across multiple continents, from Australia to Europe to Asia, Japan, and throughout North America. Extraordinarily proud of the team that we were able to assemble to do that work. I've been fortunate to work with a lot of really great, cool people that are very smart, that maybe didn't have that climate bug or that passion for energy when they joined the company, but certainly, yeah, it is motivating for them as they stay and work on some of these difficult problems. And then I'm extraordinarily proud of what we're doing at STEM. I wasn't a founding member of the STEM team. I joined 3.5 years ago when the company was, you know, into commercial operation. But since then, you know, we've gone from, you know, maybe 100 sites in operation to well over 600, and another several hundred in backlog under construction and moving into different markets throughout North America and toeholds in some other international markets as well. Each step of the way, I've been fortunate to work with great teams. In some cases, pulling people along with me as I've moved. Those teams and the work we've been able to accomplish towards this doing the right thing goal, which has very important climate benefits, is a source of pride. I'm very happy about what I've been able to do so far.
So you talked a little bit about your vision before. You talked about distributed energy being the future. But can you talk about 30 years from now, 40 years from now, what do you see the energy system looking like in the U.S. or in the world?
I'll take that from the perspective of my electric flying car.
Okay, nice. Yours are autonomous that you're just using when you need it.
Oh, no. If they're electric and flying, I'm going to own it. Although it's an interesting question. It's fascinating to me to see how many of my friends' kids, when they went through their teens, were not particularly eager to get their driver's license or to take the family car. I was so impassioned that when I was that age. Yeah. It's like that was the only thing I thought about. Yeah. So I think the economics of storage are changing so fast. I think it's tracking to changes we've seen in solar, maybe not quite as fast as solar panel declines, but the economics in storage are changing to the extent that we see that the analysts are typically changing their forecast every year. Bloomberg New Energy just came out with their 2019 forecast, and they're forecasting greater adoption, although they shifted a little bit to more large-scale, utility-scale projects from some of their earlier forecasts, which I'm not sure I would necessarily agree with. But every year, the forecasts change a little bit based on what's been happening. But I think we're at that point now where there's enough customer interest in having renewables, whether it's through a PPA or on-site generation, and the various sustainability objectives that you know, most of the enterprise, you know, in the Fortune 500 have today. You know, you just see tons and tons of investment in basically serving their sustainability goals, and again, through PPAs or on-site purchase of construction. And you couple that with energy storage and integration of, from a technology standpoint, of the flexible resources that you may have in the form of thermal loads, heating, cooling, refrigeration, and in some cases, industrial process control flexibility. And you couple that with what we see is a growing number of dynamic pricing and locational price exposures to customers. And that idea that we started out with time of use metering becomes this dynamic market where people are essentially, and you know, prosumers used a lot, but people are basically buying and selling in ways that are fundamentally different and transacted through automated systems, because technology is certainly taking us very quickly down that path. And I'm not going to go to blockchain or transactive energy necessarily. We have programs in place today that are effectively proxies for a lot of that kind of trading. But we're going to see that as being fundamentally part of all energy management landscape. And whether that's a home energy management system or a building management system, any kind of facility is going to have that sort of awareness of the time value of energy and the options for buying and selling at different times. And they'll be to different degrees and different resources, but it'll be a fundamental part of nearly every facility.
You had talked before about thinking that different homes, businesses in the future would be able to microgrid off. So do you want to talk about how that fits into an overall vision?
So there's microgrids. I mean, this is why sometimes I don't like the term microgrid, because I think it becomes confusing. And then we talk about nanogrids, and you know, it gets all over the map. I think the ability to have a facility that, in a home, business, industrial plant, that is connected to the grid, but is able to provide resiliency, right? Is able to it has a source for resiliency that can ride through, you know, shorter term or outages. And that islanding capability that you would have to have for that, most people will start to talk about that now as a microgrid. So in that context, being able to island and ride through power outages, which, by the way, I have Tesla Powerwall at home, and I had a scheduled outage that lasted 9 hours, and I rode through as one of the very few homes in my neighborhood just 3 days ago. So I think that kind of capability is fundamentally, it's grid friendly, right? Whether you want to call it as a black start resource, because look, you have all these islanded facilities, it's going to be a lot easier to bring up a grid that's had a problem. You talk about load and congestion management, the ability to say, I can go to zero energy or even generate energy is a way to think about handling congestion, right, and local capacity requirements. So I think the end game is that we have this kind of resiliency plus flexibility that becomes that sort of value stack that many people ascribe to storage, but I'm ascribing to storage plus any other flexible resource.
I share the same vision, only I think it will be a higher percentage. I see many endpoints having the capability to ride through and to play that market, that energy market. But when there's an emergency, they all have the ability to continue to go.
Yeah, and I think the EVs certainly could be one of those. And you know, look, my phone, my laptop, we all have those devices that have that ride through capability because they have batteries and storage built in. What I think is going to be interesting is how there is the word market is probably the right one to use. It can be a little bit intimidating, but to think about a market where that kind of flexibility is better monetized. Should you get a tax credit for being able to island your facility? Is that something, because there's a grid resource there, right? That you're doing something that has social benefit if you can actually do that in an emergency situation, whether it's storage-based or appropriate generation-based. If you could do that, is that something that you should incentivize somehow? I think the answer to that's probably yes.
Well, the grid supposedly is being hacked all the time, mm-hmm. and perhaps some other countries have that capability to hit us in the grid. It would improve our security posture if companies and homes and communities could island during an event like that.
Yeah, and I think PG&E's, actually California Wildfire Protection now, is looking at essentially cutting transmission during a number of hours because of wildfires, and it's already started in certain parts of Northern California. And I'm not suggesting that's a widespread use case, but there are those kinds of use cases. You can go to Houston or the East Coast, New Orleans, where you know, hurricanes and weather conditions can cause problems. And like I said, just the other night here in San Diego, I have a very reliable grid, but there was 9 hours of scheduled outage because there was some distribution upgrades. And I think the other thing that goes on here is we are facing a very much aging grid, and the investment opportunities can be determined based on what's the optimal outcome. And the optimal outcome, in my view, is not continued construction of centralized generation and transmission designed to support centralized generation. It's to basically encourage distributed resources and to encourage the integration of those with the grid that we have, and then upgrade that grid to the extent that we have to based on that future state, as opposed to that look back that says, well, yes, we need more transmission because we have to build this new big solar plant out in the middle of the desert and run lines hundreds of miles to get it to a load center.
I agree completely. Do you have any questions for me?
Where should we argue? We should argue. Come on.
I have nothing to argue with you about. Do you have any questions for me?
Look, you've been around this industry now, and since we agree, I'm going to ask you the question of, you know, what do you think is going to be that tipping point for the lean towards distributed versus centralized resources?
I don't want this to be viewed as a cop-out answer, okay, but I think you know this is the case. It's really different in every market. One thing that has tipped it to some degree already is prices. Prices have fallen enough that there's definitely some real distributed game out there. And so you've seen a lot of places distributed energy rising. You have other locations, however, where energy is very cheap from the utilities and the grid because they've made the investment a long time ago. They have to put very little into the grid that they have. There's very little motivation there to change. So very location dependent. But I would say that where energy is newer, I think distributed already has hit the tipping point where that's the way to design.
I think that's going to be one of those really interesting questions. We have LEED buildings, but are we going to have buildings with appropriate levels of DER, whether it's space for storage, circuits and panels designed to accommodate connections and interconnection practices that help to promote that built-in from the beginning? I think that's happening.
I do think that there's an issue about how much the utility needs to prepare for when there's cloudy days or when there's some event at the homeowner's site or the business owner's site. They need to pay for that backup in some way if the utility is going to prepare for that. And I think that does have to be figured out.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the policy question that I think is being addressed in many different forms, but I haven't seen the answer yet. I certainly don't have that one, you know, in my hip pocket either.
So is there anything else you want to talk about?
Other than the fact it's a beautiful day out, no, I think this has been great.
Okay, then I'm going to wrap this up, and I'm going to do it with a wrap. Oh, energy efficiency, it's what you do. You started out focusing on metering TOU. You're very pragmatic. That's what you bring, but you always want to do the right thing. You got into this to say, hey, I contributed to the movement to distributed. I'll say one thing I like about him. He uses a lot of acronym. Without smart meters, we wouldn't be able to do nothing. That's why you really appreciate the green button. Your vision of the future, it goes very far. You want to own your own electric flying car. There was a planned outage. Most people don't know what to do, but you weren't afraid because you could ride through.
That's wonderful. I am definitely keeping this recording.
Lars describes himself as a pragmatist that is driven by doing the right thing. But if he is a pragmatist, he's more of a risk taker than most. He was a pioneer in believing that energy data could unlock value and help consumers be more efficient, creating an early, successful communications network for advanced meter systems. He developed an international platform for meter data management, and he moved into distributed energy storage to help guide it to maturity. And watch out for his next role, developing a personal electric flying car. If you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.crevatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars if you're an Apple user, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. And if you're in San Diego and want to trade your concern about climate change for a few hours of some great laughs, most weekends I'm doing improv comedy at either the Old Town Improv Company or Finest City Improv or both. Contact me to confirm specific show dates. And also, if you want a release from some of life's stress or just to improve your speaking skills, consider taking a class at an improv workshop in your town. Over 30 years ago, Larsh had a vision of time-of-use rates, hourly meter data, and control systems working together to improve the electric grid. Now, with the market success of renewable energy, distributed energy resources like solar and storage, and artificial intelligence, Larsh is putting it all together, pragmatically doing the right thing to optimize efficiency, and as a result, helping to mitigate climate change.